Welcome to It's Bloody Complicated, powered by Compass. I'm your host, Neil Lawson. These are unprecedented times and we need to rise to the enormous challenges we now face. From the economy, climate change, to the state of our democracy and politics worldwide. This is the space to jump into the deep end and embrace the complexity. This podcast lets us hear from and question the best writers, thinkers, politicians, journalists and activists to share their vision, ideas and campaigns to build a good society, one that is much more equal, sustainable and democratic. It's Bloody Complicated is supported by our Compass members. If you'd like to gain access to live discussions and raise direct questions to our guests, join us and support our work. You can register at compassonline.org.uk/podcast to become a Compass member and join the next podcast. But for now, just sit back, relax, and enjoy this episode of It's Bloody Complicated.
I'm going to kick off, and then as people come in, do keep introducing yourself. I'm Lena, the Campaigns and Projects Officer at Compass, and joining us this week are Lynn Henderson and Nancy Platts. Nancy is the coordinator of Politics for the Many, the trade union campaign for electoral reform. She previously led Brighton Council and is a consultant at Campaign Collective. Lynn is the chair of Electoral Reform Society and also helps chair Politics for the Many. And in her day job, she's a senior national official at the Public and Commercial Services Union. So hi, both. It's very great to have you on the podcast. We'll start, as we always do, by asking you, where are you and how are you? And I'll go to Nancy first.
Where am I? I'm in Brighton, which I would normally say sunny Brighton, but it's very, very windy at the moment. And I'm fine, thank you. I've had an incredibly busy day and I had to run up the hill to get home in time to be here. But I'm very happy to be here. So thanks to everyone for coming.
And Lynn.
Hi, Lena. I'm in sunny Glasgow and it is sunny, but also extremely windy this afternoon. And I have been literally going through the motions this afternoon. We have a PCS National Executive Committee tomorrow that will consider the NEC's attitudes to its motions. And we have the Scottish TUC Congress at the weekend where I was looking at the delegation's view on attitudes to motions. So I have literally been going through the motions today.
Well, it sounds like you both had a day. Let's get into this conversation, which hopefully will be quite hopeful. A little bit of looking back and a lot of looking forward. But let's start with some reflections. You've both been part of an incredible campaign that's seen us through some defeats, many wins, and has us now closer to changing the voting system than we have been in living memory. Tell me about your personal highlights. What stands out about the last few years? What were the high points? And I'll go to Lynn first.
I mean, clearly the highlight of the Politics for the Many campaign was obviously getting the position passed at Labour conference. But I think over the years, and it's been more than a couple of years, Nancy and I have been working on this, each union that has signed up to either be pro-PR or to be questioning of first past the post has been a significant breakthrough for us. And combining that with so many CLPs in the Labour Party, showing their support for our cause has just been absolutely tremendous. So I think my highlight has been kind of each stage has been exciting along the way to get to the place that we are now.
Yeah. Nancy, do you have yours?
All unions have been very friendly and open towards us since we started, which quite scarily was 2017. So we are now in our seventh year of this campaign, which I think goes to show how long it can take to change things, but things can change very suddenly. But the thing that they all said to us was, this is not something that our members are raising. But, you know, if you can get our members to raise it, then we'll start to listen. So we've had actually some of the smaller unions have been consistently very supportive from the start. And PCF was one of the founder members of Politics for Many campaigns. So they've been consistently supporting and driving the campaign. But I think the highlights are obviously when you start to win people over. And I think when we got the motion passed at Unison, that was like, over 1 million members. That was a really big one to win over. Same with Unite and Ulster. So when we started winning those big unions with millions of members, it sent out a very powerful signal to not just their members, but to members just generally, trade union members and Labour Party members, to say, it's time for the world to change. There's something happening here. And I think those moments have really helped us turn a corner. And then recently we organised a dinner for trade union political officers, and we had nearly every trade union represented in that room at the dinner. And that is something we could not have achieved in 2017. I think me and Lynn would have been sat there with our bowls of porridge on our own. And it was fantastic to have everybody in the room. And then for someone to email me afterwards and say, listening to Rob Ford's presentation was a penny dropping moment. He said, "It suddenly I realised what this could mean."
Mm-hmm.
That was quite magical. So yeah, they're probably the highlights.
Yeah, both good highlights. And you've mentioned there that you've been involved in this for several years in the trade union movement for a long time. What are your reflections on both movements at this juncture? What's changed in the time that you've been working? Who's joining the movement? How are people collaborating? And what new issues have you had to contend with? And I'll go to Nancy first.
Wow, that's a big question. I think the main issues we've had to deal with are people's worries. So let's deal with those first. People are very concerned about what PR means. There was a big myth that it was all about, that the far right would get in. And obviously we've dispelled that, and we can talk a bit more about that later. And I think the second one was unions saying it's not an industrial issue. We've got to focus on industrial issues, and this is not an industrial issue. So somehow it's taking second place. And again, I think we've started to get across the message now that it is quite centrally an industrial issue, because if you can change your voting system and always have a seat at the table, then you can permanently change things in quite a sustainable way. And I think that's a real message we've got to get across now, is that if Labour get in with a huge majority, there's a worry that that people interested in the campaign will start to feel like, okay, we've done it, we've got people over the line. But of course, we all know that Labour could change things for the better for working people. And we've seen just how quickly that can be reversed under the Tories. So I think that's something we've got to keep up front and centre of the campaign.
Yeah, I think also we need to remember kind of, where we've come from in terms of, There was once a time, and it, to me, it doesn't seem that long ago, but because things have moved significantly, where the majority of Labour councillors, MPs, members of Scottish Parliament, Welsh, would say first past the post is the way of getting Labour elected, particularly in somewhere like Scotland, where I live. There was a time where the Labour Party was the establishment, and that any suggestion that you would change the electoral system would mean, a slap in the face for Labour. Obviously, things changed in the Scottish Parliament, which was a mixed system. We also had the referendum on independence here, and that balance of who is a political establishment changed in Scotland, and it has been for quite a long time now. And therefore, people here look at things slightly differently from where they did perhaps 10 years or so ago. So it's not that long ago that this was a major uphill battle, and even just convincing people in our movement that this was just the right thing to do. I'm not saying that we're there yet, but I just feel we've really come on quite a long way since that time. So that's what I'd like to have reflected on there.
Yeah. And to kind of pick up on that point, if there's a trajectory that you're on there, who are the people that we've yet to reach, both as kind of the trade union movement and as the PR movement within that?
I think there's some of the unions that are not affiliated to Labour. We haven't really done a lot of work with them. We haven't really spent a lot of time with them. So having the dinner in January was probably the first time that we've had, say, the teaching unions, and we had the Society of Radiographers and others in there, and we've not really reached out to them just because we didn't have the resources to do that. So I think, you know, it's a question for us of going through the same process of trying to do some grassroots building of the campaign. It's always been very much a grassroots up campaign in order to make it more sustainable. And that's the only way we can convince the executive committees and the general secretary, you know, they've got to take their lead from the members. So, you know, the next step really will be to just do a bit more reaching out to them and help get motions through in the smaller unions. You know, and obviously the goal is to have every trade union part of the campaign wanting to change to PR. I think the other thing we're doing is we're going to go and be at GMB conference. We're not giving up on the GMB, and I say that as a GMB member. We know we've got some grassroots support in the GMB, so we'll be going along to their conference. Anyone that's in the audience that's a GMB member and wants to come along and see us at the stall, you'd be more than welcome to come and visit us. If you come along, we'll be taking people out for a drink on the Wednesday, I think, and having a chat. It's how you get people involved. And we'll be having a chat about how we can get a motion through perhaps in 2025. So that would be a goal, to get the final large union on board.
For me also, I mean, clearly winning policy at union conferences is part of our objective in order to obviously to influence Labour, but also, you know, have those unions adopting a progressive position on electoral reform. But we mustn't forget that some of the concerns that we have about the electoral system is that workers feel excluded. They feel excluded because they see politicians as somehow disconnected from their working lives, also their connections with communities. So there's work to be done around kind of worker education and kind of community organising meets industrial organising that, you know, a lot of us in the trade union movement try and do, and kind of, you know, bring members to the issues, to their politicians, to show that they have power. And it's all connected to with what we're trying to do. And under a different electoral system, you know, people might feel more empowered to raise these questions directly with their politicians. So that's all part of the equation as well, Lena.
Yeah, absolutely. And kind of just to expand on that point, we've talked a little bit about what makes changing the voting system an industrial issue and crucial for trade unionists. But I wonder if you could speak a little bit to, are there international examples that you can point to that give us an idea of a glimpse of what the differences are between operating under first past the post and operating under a PR system?
Yeah, well, most countries where they have embedded trade union rights, where they have stronger trade union rights, where they have more collective bargaining, have PR systems. So there's a lot of European examples that show that. So that's kind of what we're using really as our basis for reform as an example, because what it does, it takes safe seats out of the equation. So and that's one of the things that would be really helpful for us, is because if you get rid of that safe seats culture, and actually every vote counts equally, then people can vote with their heart and they can start to win politicians over to their cause and their argument. And it means that you're always going to have a seat at the table. You're going to have working people have a seat at the table consistently. And that's going to make it much harder to undo any rights that a progressive government can bring in. So if you look at what happened, as soon as the Tories get elected, they bring in a piece of anti-trade union legislation and they make it much harder for working people to exercise their democratic right to take industrial action. And I'll let Lynn talk a bit more about that because she'll be more familiar with the mechanics of doing that. But they have put so many blocks and barriers in the way to make it really hard for people to take action. And they've also demonised trade unionists. They've made it, you know, everyone that start to think that this is a bad thing if you try and exercise your right to protest and to withdraw your labour. And actually, that's a very fundamental right that anyone who joins a trade union will believe in. So we want to stop that from happening. And by having a more proportional system, it would force politicians to listen more, but it would also just create that space at the table for working people to have more of a voice and to hang on to those rights when we eventually get them back.
I mean, it is bizarre that we live in a society in which trade unions are required to conduct a postal ballot for, you know, for considering strike action, when everything else is digital and online. And it certainly is a massive problem that we all face in trying to organise our workforce to go home, pick up the envelope, fill it out with a pen, take it to the post office, and remember to post it, or take it to the post box. You know, it just seems archaic, and that we're kind of stuck in this system. That's one of the, I think, demands that the trade union movement will be putting on the Labour government in terms of the anti-union laws. Without even discussing anything else, that just seems so ridiculously kind of archaic, and it's something that I think any trade union member can relate to as well. Nancy and I have been quite keen in this whole debate is to frame Politics for the Many as an organisation that's deeply engaged in democracy generally, and not just PR or electoral reform. So we've been picking up reform or abolition of the House of Lords. We've been looking at women's participation. We've been looking at kind of young voters and the sense of alienation that working class people have from the electoral system. And all these things, when you begin and open up those conversations, does draw more people in, rather than talking about which kind of PR system is the best, which there's a place for having that discussion, so someone's asking the questions.
Yeah.
But sometimes, it's important to kind of to frame things into a discursive approach, especially want to bring trade union members into the debate.
Yeah, absolutely. And I know it's a stat that I've seen somewhere, and we can find the quote the source after this, but under First Past the Post, young voters under 30 count about 10% less than voters that are older, because young people tend to live in cities in the way that First Past the Post shakes out. And that's just, one stat on that. We know the difference it makes for representation of other characteristics as well. Speaking of kind of returning home and party political strategy and moving back into the UK, there will be twists and turns and more twists and turns in the path to PR, but I wonder if you could talk a little bit about what the relationship between unions and the Labour Party will look like if they win. What leverage do you think unions have, and what tools are at your disposal through the trade union infrastructure for PR and that kind of wider democratic focus that you just talked about there, Lynn?
Yeah, so I mean, obviously my qualifier in this discussion is that PCS isn't affiliated to the Labour Party or indeed any party, but we are deeply engaged. We have a political fund. We're deeply engaged in political campaigning, political organisation. And the very first political campaign we ran was called Make Your Vote Count, where we told our members the positions of each party on some key issues, pay, jobs, public services, and let them make the decision for themselves. But we do have a relationship with Labour in opposition and Labour in government. And we, at the moment, we have our new General Secretary, Fran Heathcote, has written to Keir to ask for a meeting, which we haven't been afforded to date. And that's quite key, because in opposition, Labour is now in a position that is allowed to speak to the civil servants about its manifesto and how it takes it forward. While we would like to have the party come to the biggest civil service union and hear our perspective on that. So that's speaking from a non-affiliate, but I think the relationship between the affiliated unions and the Labour Party needs to be to, they aren't just there to payroll. They're there to actually influence, and that their membership is there to bring about influence and change. And in Politics for the Many, we're very keen to be part of that.
Nancy?
Yeah, well, that's a really it's a really interesting question from my perspective. So I was Jeremy Corbyn's trade union advisor when he was leader of the Labour Party, and I engaged with all of the non-affiliated unions as well as the affiliated unions. And I'm not sure if it was the first time that had been done, but I think they probably got more engagement from me than had happened previously. So for me, I felt there was an equal value to anybody in the trade union movement. Now, obviously, those who are affiliated are paying no financial contribution into the Labour Party. So there was always a sense that perhaps they should be the priority. But I always made time to go out to the other unions and talk to them. And I got Jeremy along to various receptions and meetings, because him and John McDonnell had always been on their parliamentary groups and been supportive of them. And I felt that we should build on that relationship and not lose it. And I think that did pay dividends along the way. And I think it certainly paid dividends for this campaign, because I've got all of those relationships, they're trusted relationships. It's opened a lot of doors for the campaign and enabled me to have conversations with people. We've also been very lucky in that ASLEF have been super supportive of our campaign, and Mick Whelan, the General Secretary of ASLEF, has been fantastic. And he chairs Labour Unions, which is the group of unions that's kind of they come together to support the Labour Party. So we've got a really good relationship from that perspective. My personal view is the relationship between the trade unions and the Labour Party has changed a bit, obviously, since Jeremy was there. I think we had a really open door. I don't know how open that door is for all of the unions to get into the leader's office these days. We have got a good relationship as campaigns with the leader's office. They are talking to us, they're engaging with us, particularly since we got the policy through Labour Conference, and we also got a National Policy Forum position. So all of that has been very positive. And I think the strength of it again has been in growing the movement and growing this campaign from the grassroots up. It's very hard to ignore a campaign when you start getting thousands and thousands of people and all of the trade, both who are Labour members, who are trade union members, and a big crossover in between. It's very hard to ignore a group of that size who as we said earlier, get that penny dropping moment and suddenly say, hang on a minute, life could be better for all of us if we have proportional representation and a fairer voting system. So I think that's where we are at the moment. I think what we're waiting to see with huge anticipation is what happens after the general election if Labour get a large majority. And we do hope that they will adopt proportional representation as a policy and actually start doing something to change the voting system. And I hope that if they get a big mandate, they will use it in the same way that the Tories have used theirs. The Tories have used a huge mandate to completely change the voting system, say for mayoral elections, back to first past the post, because they stand a greater chance of winning. So, what we want is for Labour Party to do exactly the same thing and embed a fair voting system whilst they have the majority that we hope they're going to get.
I really like that point about like what is the legacy of this incoming government, and that's a conversation that the trade unions are obviously involved in,
Absolutely.
and that has to be part of the conversation now. And Lynn's point that the leader's office should engage with PCS and the different ways, the different kind of democratic reforms that your membership is interested in, seems incredibly legitimate. And I guess further on that point, what do you think the opportunities are in 2024? Why is this a pivotal year, kind of outside the fact that we will have a general election? What are the opportunities of that election in particular to build that, to build on the grassroots movement for that argument that this is part of the legacy and this is an opportunity to really change things in the UK?
Want to go first, Lynn, or for me to
Yeah,
go?
yeah. It's again such a kind
Okay.
of like huge question. Clearly, because it is a general election year, there's always opportunity to influence and to bring about change. I really welcomed last night when there was a very kind of late night press release that from Rachel Reeves' office announcing, some progressive approach to taxation, which down the line would mean for my members, hundreds of more people collecting taxes and kind of beginning to address the the tax justice issue that we've also been campaigning on for years. So opportunities like that in kind of influencing Labour while it's in opposition to bring about change, but not forgetting the other parties, the other parties in Westminster and the other parties in the devolved nations as well. Because it's, you know, that there's relationship building to be done there for Labour, but also, you know, the trade union movement as well. In those nations, my members are also employed by devolved governments in which other parties are, you know, are in government, and we've had a long standing more progressive relationship in Scotland with the SNP in government than we've had with the current UK government, obviously. I mean, we kind of value, I mean, it's not perfect. It's, we don't have everything we want, but we kind of value making that difference. We've had a good relationship with Labour in Wales against the Tory government, you know, in the UK, and we make that difference. We don't have coverage for devolved civil servants in Northern Ireland, but we do engage through our parliamentary group in working kind of across divides there as well. So maybe it's because I'm coming from a non-affiliated union, I do think about more parties than just Labour, and we do what we can with who we can to bring together kind of more progressive approaches to developing policies in the interests of the workers.
Yeah, and we had the last podcast episode last week was all about Scotland and how the democratic left engages now, during and after the next election, how that constitutional question changes. Nancy, what are the opportunities for 2024?
Wow. Well, I'm going to stick to electoral reform type issues, I think I would love to see the Labour government bringing votes at 16. I think 16-year-olds deserve to have to vote, 16 and 17-year-olds. I think that'd be a really positive thing to do. I think that at the moment, I think young people are very disengaged and alienated from politics. They don't see much in it for them. And if you look at the policies that most affect young people, you know, frequently top of the list is coming environment, but then also housing, like affordable housing, you know, somewhere to actually live, any kind of employment rights. We've still got a lot of young people on 0 hours contracts, unpaid trial shifts, all of that kind of thing. They're getting completely exploited. And if they want to go to college or university, they're taken on a huge debt. So again, this kind of triple whammy of things, and they're not getting into jobs which are secure, which offer a pension. So back when I started work back in the 1980s, a long time ago, no, you would get a job, you'd probably stay there for quite a long time, it would have a pension, you'd have all kinds of benefits, and young people starting out in work in a lot of places are not getting any of those things. Now, if they had the vote, that would give them, I think, a huge amount more power, and particularly under a proportional system, it gives them a huge amount more power to influence the way that policies go and get better policies for young people. But I think the second thing would be, Labour started to do reform of the House of Lords and it didn't finish it last time around. I would like to see them get stuck into that and to replace the House of Lords completely, just do it once and for all with the Senate of the Nations and Regions. Because what's happened is over time, we've ended up with lots of different layers of government. Some places have got combined authority, some haven't. We've got the GLA, which is quite unique. We've got the Welsh Assembly, we've got the Scottish Parliament, we've got the UK Parliament. And nowhere are we bringing everybody together, particularly since Brexit's happened. It feels like things have become more broken up and more disparate. So if you live in one part of the UK, you get one set of rights and one kind of deal for healthcare. And if you live in another part of the UK, you might get a better deal, you might get a worse deal. And there's nowhere bringing all of this together and rationalising all these policies and trying to actually help create an equal society. So, you know, there's people, nearly 800 people now in the House of Lords. A lot of them don't deserve to be there. They get £350 a day just for turning up. They don't get taxed or pay national insurance on that. It's not a bad deal if you can get it. So I think it's time that Labour finished that job off once and for all and brought in this proper new Senate to bring people together and try and rationalise the policy and make the whole of the UK a bit more equal.
Yeah, and I'm sure the researcher on our team, Peter, would agree with you that local governments makes no sense. We're looking at the council elections and the research that we're doing, and we found somewhere around over 70% of the Conservative held councils that are up for election in May don't have a majority of the vote this time around. So it's just like there's layers and layers of this, and it just all ends up comparing
to each
other.
Third one, you just reminded me of something.
Sure.
I think the third one would be to properly fund local government again.
Yeah.
You know, as a former council leader, when you see most of your budget going into adult social care because there's no decent social care policy, you know, I think a Senate of the Nations and Regions combined with properly funding local authorities would go a long way towards equality, particularly within adult social care. It's absolutely wrong that councils are going bankrupt. And, you know, when you look around at the things that we are losing from a local authority level because councils can't fund them, it's going to be very hard to get those things back unless Labour acts very, very quickly to reintroduce a decent level of funding.
I think we're gonna go, actually no, I have one more question, and it was super quick. In your estimation, crystal ball, when do you think we'll get PR?
How quick do you want it?
There's nothing to stop them doing it straight away. I mean, the Tories change voting systems overnight and there's barely a murmur. There is nothing to stop them doing it as soon as they get into power. We'll give them a few weeks, but I'd like to see it very soon after that.
Okay, month one. When?
I was maybe being a bit less optimistic than Nancy. I thought possibly by the next again Westminster elections would be a long term target. Hopefully Nancy's right and I'm wrong.
It would be a good result. I think they've got to do it within that first term, haven't they? They've got to make the change in that first term and give everyone time to understand it.
Hello, Samuel here from the Compass office. I hope you're enjoying the discussion so far. It's Bloody Complicated is brought to you by Compass, and it's made possible by the support of our amazing members, like Eliza. Here's Eliza on why she joined the Compass community.
My name is Eliza. I've been a Compass member for about 3 or 4 years, I think. What drew me to Compass was the fact that it's cross-party and it's also not a party. I had a light bulb moment about elections, which was no one's going to win except the Tories under this system, and we have to work together. Having been previously a member of the Labour Party and then joining the Green Party, I really wanted to see parties working together, and we have people that are politicians, MPs, trade union leaders, etc. And it's quite level. There's no big hierarchy. It's quite an honest, open space where people come together. You will hear from people from all around the political spectrum actually debating the hard stuff. It's actually, let's find a solution to the problems that we have and let's do it together. We need this progressive alliance. And I would like to see people who are passionate about getting the Tories out in the next election and getting proportional representation in. Come and join Compass now and actually swell the movement, because without people, there's no power. And that's what we need right now.
Find out more about joining the Compass community at compassonline.org.uk/podcast. And now, back to the discussion.
And with that, now that we're going to get PR in like the next year, we're going to go to the next... to the members' questions. So Harry's going to invite some folks up to the panel to speak.
Yeah, so I've got a couple lined up. And the way it's going to work is I'll invite two at a time. So one person will come in and then another person will come in, and then I'll hand over to you, Lynn and Nancy, to answer. So I'm going to bring in Roland.
Hello. So where I'm coming from is really that of the way in which governments all over the world are being increasingly sophisticatedly lobbied, blackmailed, manipulated by big corporate and financial interests. And a lot of this has come to a head in relation to how COP conferences are also controlled by these interests. And that's why I'm so excited about COP30 in Brazil, as a first attempt to really have one that is a people's club. And it's in that context my thinking lies in relation to the question, which is where beyond PR, because I think PR won't solve the problem of corporate lobbying of our elected representatives. How can we use the kind of empowerment that's envisaged in a system of sortition for citizens' assemblies that work closely with the process of government in all of the four nations in the UK?
Thanks, Roland. We got one more?
Yeah, we got one more. So I'm going to bring in Kirsten now.
Hi, everybody.
Hi, Kirsten.
Hello, Lena. Thank you, Lynn. Thank you, Nancy. For again, I like this argument gets more and more mind-boggling as the weeks go by, I'm afraid. But thank you for trying to clarify some of it. Now, my question is that does the fact that the electorate seems to be turning more extreme, both right and left, does that help or hinder the argument for electoral reform? I don't mean whether we should have electoral reform, but I mean the electorate's appetite for the question in the first place. What do you think? Is it good or is it bad that the electorate is becoming more engaged, but more extreme and factionalized?
Thanks, Kirsten. Whoever wants to jump in there.
I think they're quite hard questions to answer. I guess what strikes me certainly about Kirsten's question is, if you see people becoming more extreme, is that possibly a result of the fact that they're just not being heard? They don't feel their voices are being heard. I mean, there was people throwing paint, red paint over Labour HQ, I think was in the papers yesterday, for example. Is it that people feel that the systems in place to influence your politicians aren't working? But I would also counter that with the other side, that I think politicians feel more under threat. So I think you could potentially, there is the potential to have people kind of hunkering down and behind, you know, gates and locked doors, and it's harder to get into parliament these days because people are worried about extremism. And then on the other hand, you've got people just feeling completely disempowered. That answers Kirsten's question. I don't know if I've left you, Roland. Why is the hard one about corporate lobbying? I mean, that's quite a difficult one to answer, I think.
Lynn?
I'll try and start there then, because I think there's always been corporate lobbying, hasn't there? There's always been corporate influence in politics and in government and internationally as well as here at home. I think that in this generation's presence of characters like Donald Trump and Boris Johnson, that kind of have presented a kind of corporate greed as all right in political life, at the same time that we've had a kind of increasing social media contact that the ordinary people across the world kind of see all this as some sort of game playing is being played by corporates into political life in a way that has never been so blatant before. It's always been there, but I think this is the world that we're in now, and that makes it difficult. So yes, I do also agree that the answer is things like citizens' assemblies and kind of community organising, workplace organising for unions and kind of local groups and local people coming together to raise local and raise workers' voices or kind of progressive interest voices against the corporates is for me the only way to fight back on that. And it's not easy, and it's not going to be something to achieve overnight. But there are examples, where we the people kind of have pushed back, and at the end of the day, I wouldn't be a socialist, I wouldn't be a progressive, I wouldn't be a trade unionist if I didn't think that we were going to win, and I think we will win. On Kirsten's point, I know Kirsten from the Electoral Reform Society, so nice to see you here, Kirsten. the electorate turning more extreme, or are they? Are they turning to other places because they're dissatisfied with the answer from mainstream politicians is possibly one thing. So I don't know whether you meant in voting, because we saw the Reform Party is currently kind of, you know, on the rise at the moment as well, because Labour's still running really high in the polls. But we've kind of began taking that discussion here into looking at political kind of actions that, you know, I kind of grew up in the student movement and in the peace movement, where direct action was a definite tactic, as long as it was non-violent. And there's questions. I mean, I know some of my members have had paint thrown over government buildings, have had protests outside government buildings. And what we've tried to do is to link the people that work in those buildings with the cause that's campaigning outside it. And as a trade union branch, say, let's get out there and speak to them, whether it's a benefits protest, job centres, or you know, other issues in central London. But if people feel frightened and threatened, then, you know, I do think that there's an issue to be taken up. But I sometimes worry that we've kind of lost our sense of that peaceful protest is a good thing, because we're a bit frightened of some of the potential extremists out there. So I don't know if I've answered that really well, if I just rambled on, but that was my thoughts anyway.
No, I like that. And I think, Lynn, there's something in what you just said that I want to pick up on, and I'm abusing my host's privilege here, but this isn't going to be easy. We're trying to change the nature of power in the sixth largest economy in the world. And like the way that power is legitimized and held and held on to and got in the first place and all of that. And that doesn't stop or start with PR. I think the reason that we as a movement have landed on PR is just because of the House of Commons is so so backwards and so old and so entrenched that it's, getting us out of that and bringing a little bit of light in and having the ability to fight some of these arguments and fight some of these progressive policy battles depends on us having a different type of commons and a second chamber and more devolution that actually makes sense and isn't just piecemeal and. But it has to start with something that reforms kind of that heart of representative democracy. Right, Harry, I'm going to stop adding to the podcast here.
All right, I've got two more for you. So I'm going to bring in Brian first.
Hi, two questions. One is, Labour, we got Labour over the line to adopt PR, in, so it's sort of has a resolution passed at conference. The key issue is how it gets into the manifesto. As far as I understand it, the leader's pretty much got a free run at the manifesto. So do you have any insight into what his thinking is? And I may be a little pessimistic, because I think one of you said that since post-Corbyn, you didn't really know what the state of the relationship was between Labour and the trade unions, which sort of implied to me that it might have gone downhill very quickly. And then if you've got time, I think corporate governance is a massive, massive democratic issue, and it's definitely an industrial one. So if you have time, if that relates in any way to the issue of democracy that we're talking about, I'd welcome your views on that. Thank you.
Thanks, Brian.
Right. Okay. Let me just bring in one more. So if you could just hold your thoughts for 1 second. I'm going to bring in Sue. Hi, Sue.
Hello. Can you hear me?
Yeah.
Yeah. Oh, hi. Well, I've got two questions, and I thought of an allied third. I'm a local organiser for Make Votes Matter and a member of Local Compass. My question really is, what are the unions doing about photo ID for the upcoming general election, and also, I suppose, the local elections? You know, it's a huge issue. So what are you doing now? And, you know, maybe how can we activists locally help? And for the future, do you see Do you see some sort of national ID card system like we have national insurance? You know, everybody gets a national insurance card, don't they? Why shouldn't everybody have an ID card with which they can vote? And then I was thinking, what about your Muslim members? Are they disillusioned with Labour? I'm from Oxford and half our councillors, Labour councillors, have left the Labour Party. We just got a good tranche of young women Muslims, and now they've all left the Labour Party over Gaza. So will your Muslim members be voting for Labour?
I appreciate that's a lot of questions. So answer any which you feel confident speaking to. Should we go to Nancy first?
So let me I can speak a little bit about what Unite is doing, just because I'm doing some work separately with Unite, which I can respond to C's questions about. So I know that Unite is obviously a large union. They've got over a million members. I know that they're getting briefings out to their reps about the mayoral campaign, the London mayor campaign, for example. And I write newsletters for them as well. And they keep reminding at election times, they're reminding their members and their reps to tell their members about voter ID, and they've got like a bit of space on their website which explains to people what voter ID they can have, what works. On national ID cards, you know, when I was a parliamentary candidate, I was really opposed to ID cards. I don't think we need them. I don't see why people should have to carry ID with them. That is a personal view, not a view of the campaign. You know, we have got lots of ways of showing who we are. I think the issue is more that when they brought voter ID in, it was for quite cynical reasons. It seems to be to prevent people from voting, to make it harder for people to vote, because the amount of fraudulent vote was so tiny. In some years, there hasn't been any. The ONS or the House of Commons produced lots of stats on this, and it was just a non-issue. It was literally a hammer to crack a nut. So why should we go to the expense, and why should we have the burden of having to carry ID cards everywhere? We've got lots of ways we can prove our identity. The issue is that for voting, there are lots of ways for older people to prove their identity, and very few ways for younger people to prove their identity. And if you look at the split that the age demographic and who votes for who, as we know, older people are more likely to vote Tory and younger people are more likely to vote for a progressive party. On Muslim members, again, the only thing I know, because this is not work that we do so at Politics for the Many, you know, my focus is purely on electoral reform with unions, but all I know that is that Unite is working with Sadiq Khan on messaging and things like that, and that Sadiq was one of the first people to come out and call for a ceasefire. So, you know, I think it depends where you are in the country and who your politicians are as to where members are. On Brian's points, I didn't quite get what the question was on corporate governance. Sorry, I missed that. I've just written down corporate governance. I can't remember what your question was, but you talked about Labour over the line and what's the relationship with unions. And I didn't say it had necessarily got any worse. What I said was I don't know, because I don't know. I know how good it was between Jeremy and the unions and John when I was there, because I was right in the middle of that and I was the one helping to maintain those relationships. I actually don't know what it's like. That's not to make any comment on whether it's good, bad or indifferent. So I think it's important to be clear about that.
Okay, so I guess starting with the question about corporate governance and democracy, Brian, I wasn't entirely clear about where you were coming from yourself on it, but I think it was about playing corporate governance off against industrial democracy. And it's, you know, it's not very trendy at the moment to talk about industrial democracy, but it's actually about kind of workers' say in the workplace, workers' say on the seats on the boards, engaging the workforce in the running of an organisation. Now, I'm you know, deeply in the public sector in these issues, and it's more even in UK government departments, there's still some space for, you know, workers and trade union engagement in some of the consultative bodies. But I think the idea of corporate governance and industrial democracy is something that we could have a whole podcast on. That it itself is something, you know, that's it's quite exciting to explore what needs to be done around there. In terms of the manifesto, yeah, you're absolutely right, Brian. It's now in the hands of the leadership of the Labour Party what goes into that manifesto. The only way that we can influence that is to keep the issue alive, doing things like this podcast. We're about to enter the conference season for most of the affiliated trade unions and our own. We'll keep this issue on the agenda and right through the summer and up and into the TUC Labour conference in the autumn. And, you know, keep it afloat, keep showing how popular it is the way that I would take that forward. Sue, on photo ID, if we introduced photo ID, there'd be more jobs for my members in the passport service or wherever it was time to. I think at one point they were considering that the passport office should issue the photo IDs. I don't think, like Nancy, that there's any need for a national ID card. And in fact, there's some kind of worrying human rights elements to enforcing people to have a national identity card. In this day and age, there's so many ways to prove your identity that it's not something that I think I would be supporting. On Muslim members, my union's not affiliated to Labour, but we have been engaging quite deeply during Ramadan in particular with our Muslim members around the Tory government's policies and approaches to what civil servants can and cannot do in terms of their position on international issues such as Gaza. We were one of the first unions to come out and condemn Hamas attacks, but at the same time being clear about, you know, the actions of the Israeli government have been genocide, and we continue to raise that. The UK government has closed down what is called the Civil Service Muslim Network, which isn't part of our union. It's a civil service body, and we've been supportive of our members that are part of that network to kind of come together through their trade union to continue to raise the issues that they wish to raise. So you know, I can't really speak for how members of my union feel about the Labour Party's policy, because it's not an area that I'm engaged in.
Thanks both.
Answered most of those questions.
Yeah, I think we got five in there. And so thanks very much for your answers on all of them. And just on the process of getting the PR into the manifesto, Nancy's absolutely right. Compass is a tool you can write to your Labour candidates about it. We can, if you email me, we can help you find the community service, a survey that your candidate is running to submit your concern about democratic reform to them. And the other thing I'd say is that, as Nancy said, you don't need to put democratic reform in your manifesto to then enact it in government. The Welsh government has changed the voting system in Wales without committing to that in their manifesto. And so I think there's many different paths to PR, and I think we just need to be alive to all of them so that we as a movement can take the opportunities of all of them. Harry, I'll go to two more questions quickly, and if we could please keep these two one question each so that we can get through them and let our guests away on time as well.
Great. Okay. So firstly, I'm going to bring in John.
Hi. So it's a bit complicated. So we're thinking about PR for the Commons and what system would be put in place, and how would that interact with reform of the Lords? And then correspondingly, is that a stepwise process, or do the two forms of political change have to work in lockstep with each other?
Thanks, John. One more?
Yeah. Let me just get it up because I'm going to read this one myself. It's from Graham. And the question is there consensus about which version of proportional representation we want?
Everyone's favorite question. Over to you both.
So, do you want to go first this time, Lynn?
Okay, thanks, Nancy. No, there is no consensus. And I think that we are in a place that we are discussing the principle of democracy rather than the process of which one appears. There are some people that spend an awful lot of time debating and discussing the best form of PR. But I think that the issue is that everywhere except Westminster is open to the debate and to change. In Scotland for years, even when we still had the European Parliament, every other vote was under some form of PR, all different. People adapted to it, people can do it, other than the Westminster vote. So there's not a consensus, and it's not going to be easy to kind of sail into that place. But I also think the relationship between what we're discussing around votes for the House of Commons and the plans for the House of Lords won't be a smooth transition either. It will be bumpy, it'll be over time, and maybe give us time to look at the best option to take that forward.
Nancy?
Yeah, so I think with the House of Lords reform, I mean, it's not, I think there was a bit in the Gordon Brown Commission about it. It's not something I've looked at in depth, so I don't know the answer. If I was advising on this, I would say, let's look at somewhere else that has done this. Let's look at another country that has done this and made it work, and where we actually like the model and we think the model will work. And then how can we adapt that to suit our own country? And as we talked about earlier, we've got this kind of mishmash of different political systems and different levels of responsibility. And quite often, I think my worry is that quite often people don't know which representative to contact at what level to get their problem solved. So the route to getting things solved from a grassroots perspective, from a community perspective, is not very clear. I would see that. I don't know about how they would interact. I think it's an interesting question as to whether you still have a parliament that makes legislation, then another parliament that looks at that legislation and scrutinises it. For me, as I said earlier, it would be about trying to harmonise the way that things work in the UK, to try and keep the UK and all of our rights in the same place. On the version, as Lynn said, there's many varied debates about which version of PR. I think the one thing I would really want to drive home about it is that a PR system can maintain the constituency link. Because the one reason that a lot of MPs give for not having PR, they try and bat this question away by saying, I don't know, because you'd lose the constituency link. You absolutely do not have to lose it. There are systems where you could maintain it. And we know that's important to MPs, and we know it's important to communities. So I would hope we would look at sort of respecting that view in whatever we went for, and try to keep that constituency link so people feel that the MP they're electing is empowered to represent them, because they will, and that they're going to be accountable to them.
Thanks both. I've just stuck two links in the chat on the specific question of the relationship between voting reform for the House of Commons. That's the first link, and the second link is a link to a whole backlog of papers from ERS on the House of Lords and routes to the House of Lords. And I'm sure somewhere in there, someone has done that research. And again, just to echo what Lynn said, we need to win the principle and win the argument, and fundamentally, like, the three of us sitting here and the organizations that we belong to are not going to be the people deciding what system. We are going to be influencing and advising, and we've done the work and the research to do that, but we're still winning the argument. With that, I think we are going to close, because I think if we open it up we'll get ever more questions, and we could probably have three more podcast episodes about the topics that we've touched on tonight. Huge thank you to our guests and to all the members on the call for contributing to such a lovely and actually really fascinating discussion. As always, the support of our members is really what makes this possible, and what makes it possible for us to hold these conversations and do all of our thinking and policy and campaigning work. You can tweet at us at Compass, which is at Compass Office on Twitter, and you can tune in next time to an episode about the relationship between AI, technological innovation, and democracy.
So can we get a mention in of our event as well before we go?
It's in the chat, but absolutely. Okay? Yeah. Shout it out, Nancy.
If people want to hear Rob Ford's presentation, he's an absolute expert and the one that creates these penny dropping moments. You can have a look at our Twitter feed at Politics of the Many. You can sign up there and by all means come along and join us. It's on Tuesday the 16th of April from 6 p.m. to 7 p.m. and you're all welcome.
Fantastic.
Thank you.
Thanks, folks. Good night.
So, if you like what you've heard today and want to be part of a much more equal, democratic and sustainable future, a good society, then visit us at compassonline.org.uk/podcast and you'll be able to join us live on future calls just like this one. You can tweet me at Neil, N-E-A-L underscore compass, or compass at compass office. And if you've enjoyed this week's episode, please give us a rating. It will help us reach more listeners in the future. And it's only fair that they know it's bloody complicated too.